Welcome to our special 7 questions edition of How to Win a Campaign. I'm Martin Diego Garcia, and you can find us at The Campaign Workshop on Instagram or on Threads. In this series, we're talking with some of our favorite authors, content creators, and influencers, and you can find the 7 questions blog that inspired this conversation at thecampaignworkshop.com or in the show notes. Today, we're super excited because our guest, Susan Markham, is here with us. Susan serves as the director of the Peace with Women Fellowship Program at HFX. Previously, she served as the partner and co-founder of Smash Strategies, senior coordinator for gender equality and women's empowerment at the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, director of women's political participation at the National Democratic Institute, and a senior strategist here at the Campaign Workshop once upon a time. Susan is a passionate advocate for gender equality and female empowerment and advocates for the critical role that women play in politics and development. And we're very excited because she just recently released her new book, Feminist Foreign Policy in Theory and in Practice, and we're excited to dig into it. Susan, welcome, welcome, and thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So we usually start most of our interviews in just sort of getting a background of who you are. And so I would love for you to share a little bit of more about your journey, how you became just such a passionate advocate for gender equality and women's empowerment.
Well, it's actually far in the way back. I actually got excited about this in college. I was a member of a Greek sorority, and I don't really know how I ended up there, but my mother probably made me. I had no history in it. But what we figured out is that if all the sororities joined together, we were the largest women's organization on campus. And so if we educated women about gender-based violence, oftentimes a woman is most likely to be a victim of sexual violence on campus in her first semester before her first Thanksgiving.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we were like, hey, we have access to thousands of women on campus. And so why don't we work together to help prevent gender-based violence on campus, also try to prevent alcohol abuse on campus, which often leads to gender-based violence. And so that's really where I came about. I wasn't studying it. It was just this idea, if a bunch of women work together, that we could improve the lives of other women there on campus. And then, of course, the sorority, the founding of sororities on campuses were to support women in education and give them support that they weren't getting otherwise. And so I really still continue to believe in the sisterhood model. And then when I found out, like, oh my gosh, I can actually do this as my job, like, yeah, I get to be mad and yell and have a good time every day. So that's how it started way back.
So just a original grassroots one-on-one organizing that you're sort of pulling folks together. Hey, we have a common cause. I love it.
And it's kind of weird because my mom, being from the Midwest, my mother never wanted us to discuss politics with people we didn't know. And then it turned into my job. Then I became a fundraiser and I was talking about money with people I didn't know. It was kind of their worst nightmare, but I like it.
Yeah, we get a lot of those folks who come in here are like, yeah, this is something I don't even talk about with my family. And then I get paid to do it every day. In your experience and based on the plethora of knowledge that you have, what are some of the most effective sort of strategies for really increasing women's political participation, whether that's as voters, as activists, candidates, office holders, sort of decision makers?
Well, there are a couple key steps that you can take. Obviously, you need to provide like hard skills like public speaking and fundraising. But what I've found is the first thing we need to do is demystify the political process. People think it's some secret thing. And really, in a good democracy, right, all the rules are out there and it's a transparent process. So whether it's registering how to vote or when to vote, I mean, we live this. So we're like, obviously, but it's not obvious. It's really hard to do in some places. So how do you become a voter? What does it mean to be an activist? Of course, running for office, right? Men like to think that they have some special power, but really women have a lot of the same skills and they use them to raise money for their kids' school or to organize at their church. And yet those are the same skills that you would use to run for office. So we really try to demystify the process. And then the second thing is making politics relevant to their everyday lives. So if they are going to spend all this time, you know, trying to organize their friends or, you know, hopefully run for office, they have to think, if I go there, I can make a difference. Or it's not the same old people in the capital city who won't listen to me and they won't have any impact on if I'm safer, if my kids have enough to eat, right? And so really, I think those two things where we're taking the mystery out of it, and we are helping convince them that it's a worthwhile use of their time. If they're willing to buy those two things, then we can move to the hard skills.
Right. I was like, the hard skills, we can train them. Those first two is like, you really have to sort of convince them that, yes, this is possible. And yes, you can make an impact. I think we are so much in alignment. It's why we do this podcast, right? It's why we produce so much content, is really to like lift that curtain and be like, hey, friends, you could do this too. So congrats on the next book that you have released. We're super excited to dig into that, Feminist Foreign Policy in Theory and in Practice. Can you talk to us a little bit about the writing process specifically for this new one?
Sure. So it's interesting. I write a lot of short pieces, you know, blog posts and things like that. Certainly in government, we wrote longer reports. But this idea of capturing a book that had never been written about before, we weren't really sure where to start it. And a couple of years ago, my co-author and I, Stephanie Foster, were doing a project where we were interviewing women who were working on the Women, Peace, and Security agenda. And what we found is that feminist foreign policy was kind of growing out of that. And so in this course of interviews, we kind of put a framework together. But a lot has changed, I have to say, in the last 5 years around feminist foreign policy. So we started with the interviews. There's a lot of academic literature around international relations and the field there. There are organizations in civil society who are working on this issue. And then finally, we went to government reports, because feminist foreign policy has been around about 8 years. So now governments are putting out their own official documents about what they mean that feminist foreign policy is and what they're doing to implement it. So it's kind of, we're trying to get to all different sectors there. And not surprisingly, they are not all the same. No one really agrees about what feminist foreign policy is. One hard part for us is that Stephanie and I are advocates. And so we had to write, and then we had to take a step back and say, okay, we're not trying to convince people. We're trying to be like the reporters of what this is. So saying, this is what civil society thinks feminist foreign policy is. This is what different governments think it is. But there's no right answer. We're just trying to create this overall baseline report about where it stands in 2023. And so that as people continue to implement and adopt a feminist foreign policy, they can kind of see where we've been before.
Gotcha. Okay. So can you give the listeners, without obviously giving too much away, can you give them a brief overview and sort of what inspired you to co-write this book?
Well, my business partner and I, we get along very well. We have a lot of fun together. We're kind of two sides of the same coin. She's from the diplomatic side and I'm from the development side. And so she always starts everything by thanking everyone. It's like blah, blah, blah. And I just dive right in and I'm like, that's not right. And when it comes to feminist foreign policy, I am much more like blue sky, tear down the system, end patriarchy, you know, address colonialism, and we need to start again. And she's like, well, how does this actually work in practice? You know, what can people do on a day-to-day basis? And so because we had both worked in the U.S. government, we thought that what we were adding, which a lot of people who had never worked in the government, is that we were trying to take this blue sky vision of tearing down institutions and making it workable. Because, you know, the U.S. government, we have the largest military, we have the largest foreign affairs department in the world. And so what could we do here to improve the work of our government? So that came about. It also was this idea where the ball started moving quickly. Sweden announced a feminist foreign policy in 2014. And since then, there are now 15 countries that have announced some sort of feminist foreign policy. And so we thought that this was a good time, if the ball is starting to get rolling and the movements are starting, to create this study of the baseline for these 10 to 15 countries. And then as it continues to move, then there would be something that people could refer back to.
Okay, nice. So can you give us a little bit of like key insights and or like through lines as you're talking about? So like as you're seeing all of these different pieces, are there anything that sort of rise to the top that they all sort of have in common in terms of how you would define it, in terms of what it includes?
Yeah, I mean, gender equality is a key aspect, obviously, of feminist foreign policy. But it's important to think of it is that gender equality is both a goal of feminist foreign policy and a strategy. There's been research done, Valerie Hudson out of Texas A&M, which shows that the greater gender equality is in a country, the less likely they are to be at war. They are more likely to abide by international treaties. But if you have massive gender inequality in a country, they are much more likely to be either in intra-conflict or interstate conflict. So gender equality is great on its own, but as you work towards gender equality, you're also improving economic systems, you're improving social systems, you're improving the education system. And so it's really both a strategy and a goal. The second thing is feminist foreign policy advocates for a broad definition of what security means. Oftentimes, when people joke about peace processes or foreign policy, it's men and guns talking to other men about guns. And that's what it is. And really, for most people around the world, women and men, but especially women, security is a very personal issue. Am I in control of my own body? Am I worried about violence against myself or my children? Do I have enough to eat? Am I going to have to move because of climate change? Is the electricity going to be on at night? So this broadened definition of what security means really is important, because everyone is impacted by foreign policy of one country or another, often the U.S. foreign policy, but they don't have a voice in what that means to them. And so, you know, everything that happened with Ukraine, people were like, oh my gosh, the first war since World War II. And we're like, okay, first of all, we've had two decades-long wars that the U.S. was involved in. Like, I'm sorry, you don't know anyone, but we've been at that war. But for many countries since the end of World War II, they've never been at peace. If you think of the regional conflicts that have gone on in Asia and Africa, the Middle East, like, this World War II order is not working for them. And it hasn't worked for them for a long time. And so thinking about what security means, when I'm talking to people in the security sector now, they're like, you know, this is all fluffy duffy, whatever you're doing, but my job is to keep Americans safe. And what I say is, well, you know what? If they didn't hate us so much, we wouldn't have to spend so much on bullets and bombs. And so why don't we work with them just to avoid the whole war thing instead of trying to win them over through invasion? So it's a long-term process, but I think this broadened idea of security really helps people think outside kind of the budget system and, you know, how we're spending all that money on the military in the U.S. That's the other thing, is that we're trying to rebalance some power imbalances that have existed. So within our own government, you know, our defense budget is 100 times what it is for the diplomacy and development. You know, how much we spend on Peace Corps, it's like couch cushions, right, for the Defense Department. So how do we rebalance that? How do we also rebalance the governments that have strong foreign policy and those impacted by it? So when our diplomats are out there in our embassies, when other U.S. government folks are out around the world, are they listening to the people who are going to be impacted by our foreign policy so that some of that input can get back to the decision makers here?
I mean, fascinating. I would love to see us as a country be a leader in this vein of thought process and framework on, right, like, how do we engage other countries, how do we sort of set the benchmark for how other countries should engage with each other that isn't solely military based, right? Like, it isn't solely.
And even for a long time, and the work that I did, we were in democracy promotion, where we were helping people become democracies. But now, like, they're like, okay, we're not really listening to you anymore because we've seen some kinks in your system there. And so I think going out with humility and saying, we aren't the best, right? We just try things all the time. We're an experiment that keeps happening and we keep changing and moving things about. And so we're just here to share what we've learned, but we'd like to learn from you too, and go out in much more of a, you know, equal relationship with other countries and other leaders around the world.
Yeah. So women in politics and development is obviously central to your work, and it sounds like you have quite the passion for it. Can you share some success stories or examples of initiatives either you've been involved in or you've seen that have made a significant impact?
Well, I have to tell you, my favorite story of all time, I was doing work in the country of Yemen. And in they obviously not now because they're back in war, but between wars, they were doing a constitutional convention. We would call it a constitutional convention. There were representatives coming from all over the country to rewrite their constitution. And thankfully, the UN had forced them to do a 30% quota for women in the delegates. And so our job was to make sure that the women who wanted to serve or who were nominated by their political parties to serve would be ready to go. So we did a set of trainings because we didn't want the women to be like on the women, youth, and sports or whatever crazy committee they would have committed. We wanted women to be on every committee in every meeting across. So we talked to them about all those different sessions. You know, if you have localized government, how do you do voting? What's the judiciary look like? Like every aspect you would think that would be discussed in a constitutional discussion. And then we gave them the hard skills once again, how to speak in public. You know, here's your research, da, 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 da. So we worked for months on this. Then I went away and then I came back and they were in the middle of it. And I was like, how's it going? And they're like, it's awesome. Like, we are totally engaged. We know what's going on. And every once in a while, the whole convention would get together in this huge ballroom in Sana'a. You know, just think of like a huge empty hotel ballroom, except for there's a big stage up front. And then there's just rows and rows of chairs. And about 300 people are going in there. And the women were telling me, they're like, we're there on time. We sit in the front row. We have like our pens and papers ready to go. And we are ready to comment. And being on time in Yemen is kind of unheard of. Someone once told me, they said, I hope you die in Yemen time because it will be late. And so that's, I mean, showing up an hour late is like no big deal for them. But these women were not. They were there. And they said, you know, a couple weeks in, some warlords who pretty much run the country came in, walked right to the front of the room and looked at them like, you're in our seats. Even though there's no assigned seating. Mm-hmm. And the women were like, no, these are our seats. We were here. We're prepared. We're actually part of this discussion. So I'm sorry, but these are not your seats. And for me, although everything that's happened since then, this constitution is in shreds somewhere, it changed their mind. They were active and qualified citizens of their country, and they were no longer going to be put in the back row or have to step aside for these men who, through, you know, violence, had really run the country for decades. And so that, and many of the women that I worked with in Afghanistan, like, you can't change back that mindset. When they understand their role and that they're qualified to be in that role and they deserve to be in that role much as anyone else, it really, really spoke to me about the power of this. And as much as we want to change systems and we want to have the right candidates win and all that, I think working with individual citizens to see their part in the way their country works to help them and their families was really incredible.
How inspiring, how inspiring. Once you have the lens, there's no taking it back, right? Once you've seen it, there's not being, you can't unsee it.
Right.
Which is fantastic. And I would imagine only then becomes that ripple effect for not only their communities, but for generations, their families, their daughters, et cetera.
Yeah.
How fantastic. So looking ahead, what do you believe are some of the most pressing issues currently in the field of gender equality and female empowerment? And how do you see yourself playing a role, and how can others potentially play a role in addressing these challenges?
Well, I do think there are two kind of really fundamental issues that we have to deal with, which is sexual and reproductive health injustice, both in the United States and abroad. Once again, if women cannot control their own bodies, then they cannot control their own lives in any way. And so we have to address that. I think the Biden White House is thinking creatively about how they can do that. They're working with lots of partners out in the states to make sure that we can work on that. I think we need to have a long-term solution, though, because we, piece by piece, and looking at the map, it's horrible. We need to think outside the box and not just keep doing the same things we're doing, because obviously the more conservative parts of our society have been planning this for decades. And so we need to also think long-term and think about how to do that. And the same with our foreign policy. The swinging back and forth about what we're funding overseas in other countries when it comes to women's healthcare is ridiculous. Our partner countries are sick of us changing the budget every 4 to 8 years. And quite frankly, in many places around the world, most recently in Latin America, people are legalizing, they're putting abortion rights into their constitution. Mm-hmm. So we need to be moving more in that direction and understanding the full aspect of that. And then, as I previously mentioned, this idea of democracy. Democracy is not election day. Democracy is 365 days a year. In the US, we have an opportunity because we have so many elections, right? We're never probably 200 days away from an election somewhere. In many countries, they have one election every 5 years, and it's everything from the president all the way down to local councils. And you vote for everything. There's no elections in between. So we have a great opportunity here to continue to learn from what's going on here, expand voting rights for everyone, and help citizens understand that this isn't something that you just tune into every 2 or 4 years, but every day their lives are impacted by the elected officials that are there. And the now, this really sneaky, crazy shit they're doing in between elections to try to really contract democracy in our country and have less people to vote. So I think with both of those things, there's ways to get involved from your local official, like going down the street to your Planned Parenthood, your local political parties who are working on these, all the way up to the national level, and then obviously at the global level as well. There's unfortunately a need for it at every level. And I urge people to just get involved where they feel comfortable, because the most important thing is that they get involved. And so whoever you know, get out there and do that. Certainly, when I was in the U.S. government, one of the worst things is that I couldn't do a lot around U.S. politics because of the Hatch Act. But now that I'm out, like, and you can do so much online now. So I started doing voter protection hotlines. I'm an early riser, so I would like do it 6 to 9 in the morning and answer hotlines from people all over the country. I was trying to be from D.C. as much as I could in those key states. My home state's Ohio. So my God, they need all the help that they can get. So doing whatever I can in targeted ways to continue to move in those specific issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, unfortunately, there's plenty of opportunity for us to sort of step in and take some action to help mitigate some of these pieces. One quick last question. We ask this to everybody, just as our listeners are continuing to think of new ways to get themselves educated. Any favorite podcasts, movies, or TV shows that you're digging into at the moment?
I've been watching The Diplomat on Netflix. I love that show. The lead character, I think, is feisty like I am. And I thought it was realistic. Like, when I travel, I only wear black suits. I don't know. I don't want to ruin an episode. But anyway, someone brings her a gray suit that she has to wear. And of course, within, you know, a half hour, she's spilled food on it and is upset. And I'm like, I know, that's why, you know, I only wear black and gray when I travel. So I only have to bring black shoes. Some of the things that were on, I was like, See that? And I point to my husband all the time. I'm like, that's why I'm crazy, because this is the way it's supposed to work in the real world. So I really liked that show. I thought it was funny and irreverent and pulled the curtain back a little bit on how the development diplomacy worlds work in the U.S. government.
Oh, fun. I have not seen it. I will put it on my list of things to watch. Thank you so much for your time. How can folks connect with you, the work that you're doing? Where can they find the book? Give us all the information.
So the book is available on the Routledge page. That's the publisher, or on Amazon.com. And I'm on X at Ms. Markham, M.S. Markham. And also I'm on LinkedIn. I check that fairly regularly because I'm trying to wean myself off other social media. So I can't believe LinkedIn is the growth after all these years, but it seems to be.
It seems to be where folks are finally being like, you know what? This seems civil enough for me to be on.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Well, Susan, thank you so much for joining us and for all of the work that you're doing, honestly.
Oh, thank you. You too. I know you guys are deep all the time in campaigns and other, not just political campaigns, but others as well. So I appreciate you as well.
Of course. For more on this topic or to check out Susan's book, you can check out our blog at thecampaignworkshop.com. And if you want to hear more of these interviews, be sure to like, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We will make sure to have the links to her book in the show notes. So until next time, I'm Martin Diego Garcia, breaking down how to win a campaign.
How to Win a Campaign is Joe Fold, Martin Diego Garcia, Elizabeth Rowe, Phoebe Retta, Samantha Sondek, and Lauren Odom. Music by Daniel Pinto. Audio editing by Christopher Lang. Special thanks to the team at the Campaign Workshop. Please review, like, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.